Here's the word of God to us from Hebrews 2, 10 to 18, and then 9, 11 to 14. For it was fitting that he, for whom and by whom all things exist, in bringing many sons to glory, should make the founder of their salvation perfect through suffering. For he who sanctifies and those who are sanctified all have one source. That is why he is not ashamed to call them brothers, saying, I will tell of your name to my brothers. In the midst of the congregation, I will sing your praise. And again, I will put my trust in him. And again, behold, I and the children God has given me. Since, therefore, the children share in flesh and blood, he himself likewise partook of the same things, and through death he might destroy the one who has the power of death, that is the devil, and deliver all those who through fear of death were subject to lifelong slavery. For surely it is not angels that he helps, but he helps the offspring of Abraham. Therefore he had to be made like his brothers in every respect, so that he might become a merciful and faithful high priest in the service of God to make propitiation for the sins of the people. For because he himself has suffered when tempted, he was able to help those who are being tempted.
Second reading is taken from the book of Hebrews, chapter 9, verses 11 through 14. But when Christ appeared as a high priest of the good things that have come, then through the greater and more perfect tent, not made with hands, that is not of this creation, he entered once for all into the holy places, not by means of the blood of goats and calves, but by the means of his own blood, thus securing an eternal redemption. For if the blood of bulls and goats and the sprinkling of defiled persons with the ashes of a heifer sanctify for the purification of the flesh, how much more will the blood of Christ, who through the eternal Spirit offered himself without blemish to God, purify our conscience from dead works to serve the living God? This is the word of the Lord.
In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit. He wrote the book in a little more than 6 weeks, finishing the first week of December 1843. Within 2 weeks, the London publisher Chapman and Hall ran a first printing of Charles Dickens' A Christmas Carol. They ran 6,000 copies. All of them were sold out by Christmas Eve. Within 6 months, they ran six more editions. By May of 1844, they had sold out of all six printings. Since then, you know quite well, dozens upon dozens of stage, film, television, even operatic adaptations of A Christmas Carol have made their way into the culture of Western civilization. And in its nearly 175-year history, A Christmas Carol has never gone out of print. Ever. Which shares the distinction of Shakespeare and Melville and Jane Austen and Crusoe and the like. Why? Why has this story endured? Of all the stories that have Christmas in the background or the foreground, why has this one stuck? Why are my kids drawn to some version of this story, no matter how poorly it's done every year? Why lean in? Why listen to that? Why will people probably 100 years from now still be talking about this story and yet will likely have never heard of Home Alone? Why? This story charms us. It sobers us. It takes us to our highest joys. It confronts our deepest fears. But I think this story endures because it's a redemption story. Ebenezer Scrooge is genuinely transformed, and that's something that we all long to see happen in us. That's why we're drawn to it. But his transformation is genuinely in keeping with the connotation of the word redemption. What does redemption mean at its core, at its essence? It means a liberation. It means being freed from something akin to a real enslavement. I erred on the front of your bulletin this morning. There's a first time for everything, right? That quote from A Christmas Carol is not spoken by Scrooge. It's spoken by Marley, the ghost of Marley. It's the ghost of Marley who says to Scrooge in the first stave of the book, he says, "I wear this chain I forged in life. I made it link by link and yard by yard. I girded it of my own free will, and of my own free will I wore it." It's in the next paragraph that Marley warns Scrooge, "You too are forging your own chain that you will wear unless things change." Scrooge's demeanor in the first part of the book bespeaks a condition that he is unable to sympathize. He is unable to rejoice. He is unable to think of anyone other than himself. And that is something just like an enslavement. And we get that. So we're drawn to this story because we like stories of transformation, but also because we know what it's like to feel enslaved to something that we have no power over. I feel that. I was looking over my journal from 6 years ago this morning and finding things in that journal, finding struggles written down there that I am still battling with. I know what it means to be enslaved to something. So do you. That's why this story sticks. And that's why we understand something like what Bill Murray says, who's also on the front of your bulletin, who also made a very bad adaptation of A Christmas Carol in the 80s called Scrooged. But when he said in a recent interview, "Why don't you have a girlfriend?" He said, "What stops us is that we're really kind of ugly if we look really hard. We're not who we think we are. We're not as wonderful as we think we are. And it's a little bit of a shock." It's hard. It is. We don't just need to be re-educated. We need a new freedom. We don't need just a new habit. We need a new heart. And so we've been asking the question throughout Advent, why does the incarnation matter? Why does it matter that God came to earth as a human? Why does that matter? And today we're going to answer the question by looking at Hebrews again and by saying this. The reason the incarnation matters is because by it we have the most expansive and lasting redemption there is. That there is a liberation that we get from Jesus from what most enslaves us. That's why it matters. And just as there were three spirits that came to redeem Scrooge, so there are going to be three truths that appear in this passage upon which the redemption of Jesus rests. And if you'll forgive the departure from Dickensian erudition, the 3 points are these. The reason the redemption matters is that he's all us, he's all in, and he's all done. That's where we're going. Ready? He's all us. What does that mean? We've been in the book of Hebrews for much of the time in Advent because the author of that epistle is taking pains, perhaps more so than any other New Testament book, to drill down not so much into what Jesus said, but in who he is and why his identity is so significant to our condition. And you would expect the author of Hebrews to do that, to make that very extended profile, because he's talking primarily to a Jewish audience who has had all of its categories literally upended. The gospel of Jesus was a fulfillment of their deepest desires and yet so off the map of their wildest expectations that they needed somebody to make clear why Jesus is not just credible, but why he's worthy of worship. And the first notion that Jews had the hardest time getting their heads around is the same notion that you and I have the hardest time getting our heads around. Namely, that Jesus, who was God, was nevertheless all us. And I mean that in two senses. He's for us and he's like us. He's for us in the sense, just if you just were to cursorily scan the first 5 or 6 verses of this passage, you're going to find the language of family, of filial relationship. It's the most present observation, what do I see, in the first part of the passage. Verse 10 speaks of bringing many sons to glory. Verse 11 speaks of one not ashamed to call them brothers. Verse 13 and 14 speak of the children of God. That's really noticeable. It's really repeated. And whether those references are to sons or to brothers or to children, they all have the same constituency in mind. They're all referring to those whom Jesus came to redeem. And by using those words, it means that we are to Him more than just mere beneficiaries, more than just people that Jesus had pity on, though those are true. For God to refer to those whom Jesus came for as brothers, sons, and children means that that's an implication of affection. That means that God delights in those He came to redeem. Just as you delight in those you love. You will remember not so long ago from John chapter 1 that Jesus in John 1:14, he didn't just give us the right to be the forgiven of God, though that's true. He gave us the right to become children of God. Those in whom God takes pleasure. If you're a parent, you know what it's like to take pleasure in those you love. If you've never had children, you know what it's like to take pleasure in those whom you have invested time, love, sweat, tears, and energy on. You know that. You felt that. That's pleasure. That's delight of a mysterious, ineffable nature. And if we can feel it, can you imagine what it means for God to call us children? When in our passage it says at the end of verse 11, He is not ashamed to call them brothers. The He there, that's Jesus. And it's echoing something similar to what Jesus will say to His disciples in John 15. What does He say? No longer do I call you servants, for the servant doesn't know what his master is doing, but I have called you friends. For all that I have heard from my Father, I have made known to you. Brothers and sisters, that's endearment language. That's not, oh, come on if you must. That's I love you language. That's God through Jesus saying, in spite of you, I am for you. Period. Full stop. If God is for us, who can be against us? That's what Paul asks in Romans 8, and that's what the author of Hebrews is echoing here in our passage. And there's an implication that's to be drawn out from hearing that God is for us. If God is for us, then brothers and sisters, whatever it is that's pushing back against you, whatever you're afflicted by, whoever might be hating you, or dismissing you, or disparaging you, or discouraging you. If God is for us, then you have to put everything else that's against you in that context. Because if you don't, you're going to get sullen, or you're going to get combative. And that's why our redemption begins with believing that God is, in fact, for us. But for Him to be for us, to be really for us, He had to be like us. And that's the other sense of Jesus being all us. That passage, this passage, makes the fact that He's like us amply clear. Verse 14, it couldn't be more unequivocal. Since therefore the children share in flesh and blood, He Himself likewise partook of the same things. In verse 17, He had to be made like His brothers in every respect, so that He might become a merciful and faithful high priest in the service of God. Why did He have to? Why did He have to come as a human? Why couldn't God just come to us in His essence as the Father, as the Spirit who is invisible? Why come in the form of flesh? If you just look at the swath of redemptive history, God's pattern has always been to make those who represent humanity to be like that humanity. He has always chosen to make those who have come to bring healing and freedom to be like those that they've come to heal. Moses, David, the prophets, they're all like those who represent His people, who have come to bring guidance to His people, who've come to bring wholeness to His people. That's why it's not out of the margin of error that God would make one like himself and make like one who is like us to bring healing. Dr. Abraham Verghese worked at the University of Texas in San Antonio. He now works as a physician at Stanford University. And he gave a TED Talk several years ago where it's his observation that the medical profession has become an industry on the likes of what they've come to adopt is a protocol that is entirely at odds with the very essence of their role. It's his lament that medical professionals do so very little ever to listen, ever to touch the patient that they're out to treat. Such that he said, in medicine to come in the next 10 years, what is most critical to the future of medicine is found in the power of the human hand to touch, to comfort, to diagnose, to bring about treatment. I still find the best way to understand a hospitalized patient is not by staring at a computer screen, but by going to see the patient. It's only at the bedside that I can figure out what's important. What Dr. Verghese has realized in his decades of serving patients is that the only way he can really serve them, the only way he can really treat them is to become like them. To recognize the only thing that distinguishes him from them is that they carry an affliction. And therefore, to treat the patient any differently than he would treat himself is to deny the dignity of the one he's out to treat. And so to be for the patient, he must become like the patient. He must get down into the patient's condition that he might genuinely treat them. Brothers and sisters, Jesus has done what Dr. Verghese is talking about. But he's done so to treat an even more menacing affliction than any affliction that you and I might ever come to a doctor for treatment for. And in Jesus doing that, he proves that he is all us, for us and like us. What's the implication of the fact that he's all us? Brothers and sisters, let me ask you this question. If our redemption, which we haven't really even outlined yet, that's coming, I promise you. If our redemption is so bound up with Jesus coming to relate to us in the sense that he came to know us as we are, then isn't our understanding of that redemption, isn't that working out of the redemption in us, isn't that also bound up with coming to relate to him? To knowing him in his fullness, not just as a haphazard, maybe epiphany, but as a plan, as an effort. As you seek to know anybody else, there's some sort of strategy behind it. Do you have a strategy to understand him? Are you dry right now, even in the midst of Advent? Does the idea of spirituality run off you like water off a duck's back? I read a quote from George MacDonald last night that C.S. Lewis quoted. George MacDonald said to us about spiritual dryness, he said this, "That man is perfect in faith who can come to God in the utter dearth of his feelings and desires without a glow or an aspiration, with the weight of low thoughts, failures, neglects, and wandering forgetfulness, and say to him, 'Thou art my refuge.'" If you can come to God even when you have absolutely not the slightest desire to come to God, you are more ahead than you know. And you are, in some sense, reflecting the extent to which Jesus came unto you. Brothers and sisters, he is all us. We have every reason to seek to be near him. He's all us, but he's also all in. He holds nothing back. He keeps nothing in reserve. He yielded all, he gave all, he committed all. And the fact that Jesus is all us is itself testimony to the fact that he's all in. To enter into the full limitations of humanity, subject to time, to hunger, to thirst, to death, that is evidence that there is no frugality on Jesus' part. He is all in by being all for us. But he's all in two other senses also. He's all in for God. In the early part of the passage, the author of Hebrews is going to rattle off three Old Testament texts. The first, in verse 12, is actually taken from Psalm 22, which you may be familiar with because it's that psalm that Jesus quotes from the cross, where he says, my God, why have you forsaken me? But the excerpt that this author pulls out comes from later in that psalm. That part in the psalm that strikes a more triumphant tone. The part in the psalm that says, I will tell of your name to the brothers in the midst of the congregation. I will sing your praise. Like everyone who ever wrote any New Testament work, the author of Hebrews is going back through his Hebrew Bible and he's beginning to see things that maybe the author of that Old Testament text had never dreamed of, never thought of before, but which has an ultimate completion in Jesus. And the author of Hebrews is saying to us and connecting Psalm 22 to Jesus to say this, like no one had and like no one since did Jesus proclaim God to those who would become his children. Others had spoken for God. Others had represented God, but none had been referred to as God himself. Which is why in verse 13, the author of Hebrews cites the prophet Isaiah, I will put my trust in him. Behold, I am the children God has given me. Hebrews is seeing in Jesus the fullest expression of what was on display, but on a much smaller scale in Isaiah. In becoming his spokesman, Isaiah had to place his trust in God, given what he would face in that role. And in that role, he would be entrusted by God with those who would listen to his ministry. Hebrews is telling us that like no one had or since, did Jesus have to put his trust in God to execute God's will? That like no one had or since, did Jesus take care of those whom God had entrusted to his care? And that is surely borne out by what Jesus says in John 10. My Father who has given them to me is greater than all, and no one is able to snatch them out of my Father's hand. Jesus brings to an utter completion what Isaiah may have only ever dreamed of. That is part and parcel of Jesus being all in for God. Let me bring it down to a little bit more accessible level for a moment. When you're a kid, you have very little concept of the worth of anything, the intrinsic worth. Everything is a toy, or if you're hungry, an opportunity for food, right? And so you treat everything the same. And in many cases, with a regard that is not equal to the worth of that which you are holding or teething on. And it's only when you start to see others treat some things with greater care that you begin to discover the worth of those things. Your experience in the faith may be very familiar with the sense that God at times seems remote. He may seem remote to you at this very moment. When his ways are in fact, just like what Paul says, inscrutable, incomprehensible. When the way that things have turned out lead you to ask, if not vocally, but inwardly, who is this God? Why is he worth our worship when all the world seems to be devoid of his presence or his plan? When you're thinking that, what do you do? You look at Jesus' regard for God to grasp God's true worth. Even when you don't get it, even when you can't see it, you can see how he esteemed, how he valued, how he gave himself for the very glory of his Father. And then you see perhaps more clearly why it's fitting that you incline yourself to him. Anybody that would lose all for our sake and for God's glory will help you to recapture a sense of God's worth. Jesus is all in for God, and also he's also in all in for love. That the redemption that he brought would be achieved only by his own death. What does that prove? That he is unsurpassably sacrificial. But it moreover proves how constrained by love he was in order to free us from our enslavement. And I know that, and you know that, because we know what it says in John 3. For God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son. We know what Jesus says in John 13. Greater love hath no man than this, that he lay down his life for his friends. We know what they say of Jesus when he wept in John 11. See how he loved him. We know that. We get that. We hear that. It almost goes beyond without saying. But the implication of that for life is this. Life is often born through death. Not by seeking to avoid it. Freedom for others is often wrought by becoming, in a sense, constrained by love for them, risking for them, sacrificing for them, giving up what you might otherwise keep. In being all in for us and for God and for love, Jesus exemplifies one enduring principle. Bringing life and freedom to another will most likely mean dying to self. He who would gain his life will lose it, Jesus said, but he who loses his life for my sake will find. He's all in, just as he was all us. But he's one more thing too. And here's where we drill down into the nature of this redemption. Jesus is all done. And what I mean by that is that what he did to bring us redemption, he did definitively. It's without question. He answered and met what does most to steal life from us, what keeps us from living free. And he does that in three ways. He approaches death, he approaches guilt, and he approaches our folly. He deals definitively toward death. It says at the end of verse 14, he came to destroy the one who has the power of death, that is the devil, and deliver all those who through fear of death were subject to lifelong slavery. Here's the language of redemption. The notion that we are in a predicament that's akin to being enslaved. We are neither free, nor are we free to escape. And Jesus has come to deliver us. As things stand, you and I are destined for death. We are unable to avoid what awaits us despite our best efforts to forestall it, because death is not merely a destiny, it's a power. And so you and I may come to terms with death, but we can't make nice with it. And that's why it is fitting that we should listen to a poem by Dylan Thomas when he says, "Do not go gentle into that good night. Old age should burn and rave at close of day. Rage, rage against the dying of the light." Brothers and sisters, we die but once, but we fear that death 10,000 times. It's that fear that can cast a pall upon us. It seizes us with dread. It's that fear that will whisper cynical thoughts in your ears. None of this matters. What's the point? It's the fear of death that will prompt us into almost maniacal moves to experience all we can, accomplish all we can, amass all we can, whether it's good for us or not. That's where that fear will go with us. The fear of death holds us all like a man in chains. And so the only thing that could ever unshackle us from that fear is to know that death does not, in fact, have ultimate power. Well, what in the world would ever do that? It is the death and resurrection of Jesus that overturns the stranglehold of death, but it also confronts the fears that are associated with it. He's done all of that to act definitively toward death. And in the same moment, he's acted definitively toward our greatest predicament, which you might think is death, but it isn't. It's in facing a holy God. At the end of verse 17, it says that Jesus came to make propitiation for the sins of the people. He's talking there about how Jesus brings us pardon for all our sin by way of turning aside the righteous wrath of God. That's what the word propitiation means. Now, that's a word that is often played into the caricature of God as somebody that's just a curmudgeonly deity that gets a thrill out of punishing people. But brothers and sisters, when you understand His wrath properly, you understand that His love and His anger are inextricably intertwined. Love for what is true and pure and good provokes His anger when efforts are undertaken to besmirch it. And yet it's His anger toward sin that provoked His love in sending Jesus to turn aside the Father's anger. They go together. They can't be separated, even though they're distinct. And invariably, people across the centuries, and even more so today, are asking the question, why did God have to send Jesus to die to forgive us? Why couldn't He have just decided to forgive? Bear with me here. When you cut your finger and you bleed, there is an enzyme that's released called catalase. It's inside your cells, and when you cut yourself, you've damaged cells, and so there's this groundswell of catalase flowing throughout a bleeding wound. And when you apply hydrogen peroxide to that wound, there's a chemical reaction, an unavoidable reaction between the peroxide and the catalase. And what happens when those two things together, water and oxygen, forming bubbles 200,000 times a second, I'm told. I don't know how they counted that, but they did. You can't put hydrogen peroxide and catalase in the same place at the same time without that reaction occurring. Otherwise, the catalase and the peroxide cease to be what they were. Their nature has been stripped of them. God is not a chemical reaction. He is nuanced in His responsiveness to some things. But God ceases to be God if He looks past human sin without something to bring reconciliation for it. Something has to satisfy the demands of His holiness. And as we said many times before, you know that, because when there's been any violation in any human relationship you have ever had, you know someone has to die to themselves, to the anger, to the vengeance, to the bitterness, in order for that relationship to ever be reconciled. If it's true for you, who are you to say it shouldn't be true for God? Something has to die to restore what's been lost between us and God. And it's Jesus that becomes the one upon whom the reaction between sin and God's holiness falls. His blood spills, but from it a liberation is coming to us through forgiveness. That's a definitive move. That's a definitive redemption. There is no more blood to be spilled to forgive your sin. It's done. He has solved your guilt problem just as He has solved your death problem. But He has solved one other way by acting definitively toward one other thing. He's acted definitively towards your inclination to folly. We're going to be talking about that a lot in the coming year when we talk about the book of Proverbs and try to figure out what is wisdom and how does it play out in the real world. But the four verses from chapter 9 here in Hebrews are essentially making one point. The sacrifices in the Old Testament, what they did was temporary and superficial, whereas what Jesus did was final and full. The blood of bulls and goats, the ashes of a heifer sprinkled upon the altar, that would render one ceremonially clean to participate in the worship and community of God. But those sacrifices really couldn't get down to what ate you inside, knowing that you were guilty before God and those you offended. Nothing could really show you the utter folly of what you have done by the blood of bulls and goats, such that when King David commits his egregious sins towards Bathsheba and Uriah and his Nathan, his friend, his contrition turns into Psalm 51. And in that psalm, he recognizes that only a contrite heart mattered. That only and always will a contrite heart be accepted by God. and fulfill what any blood sacrifice might seek to accomplish. Isn't David's experience then a window into how we need something more than the blood of goats to cleanse us on the inside? What goat or bull could ever cover the sins of adultery, treachery, hypocrisy, and murder? None. What ashes of a heifer could really serve to wipe away everything that's come forth from you as evidence of what's in you that needs redemption? Jesus' sacrifice was, in the words of verse 12, once for all. He's done. He's dealt definitively. And His one sacrifice is sufficient to purify the conscience from dead works to serve the living God. What does that mean? It's by the death of Jesus that the guilt of doing what leads to death is solved, but it's more than that. It's by Jesus' death that we will finally see the folly of what leads to death so that we might choose what leads to life. Among the moments that the ghost of Christmas past takes Ebenezer Scrooge to is a moment when there was a woman that he had once loved in an earlier day, when they were both younger and poorer. But the ghost of Christmas past takes Scrooge to a moment where he has a conversation with that woman much later, when his love for her had cooled and his love for money had grown. And she says to him, not bitterly, but pointedly, even lamentfully, she says, "You fear the world too much. All your other hopes have merged into the hope of being beyond the chance of its sordid reproach. I have seen your nobler aspirations fall off one by one until that master passion, gain, engrosses you." She's telling Scrooge that to avoid the disdain of the world, he has, so to speak, sold everything else he loves in order to gain riches, even selling his love for one who had loved him dearly. The ghost of Christmas past takes Scrooge there that he might see the folly of his way and be cured of it. Jesus Christ is doing that for us by going to a cross and saying unto us, "Are you sure that the ways you have sought to make yourself full, the ways you have sought to become your own master, the ways you have sought to make yourself acceptable to God, are you sure they are wisdom?" He dies to show us that they are folly. We will struggle all our lives to trust that Jesus is enough. But Jesus has done enough to show us that He is enough. Because He's all us. He's all in. And He's all done. Which means, to bring this to a head, it's all good. And what I mean by that is this. A Christmas Carol may only be a work of fiction, but in some ways, Ebenezer Scrooge is a prototype for what it means to be redeemed by Jesus. Because when he is transformed, when he is redeemed, he is ever more characterized by three things: gratitude, generosity, and a gladness that is not of this world. If the redemption we have in Jesus is true, then we have the most reason to be grateful. Because we will see our death differently, we will reckon with our sin differently, and we will see our folly differently. We have a reason to be grateful. If the redemption in Jesus is true, then we have the most reason to be generous. Because we see that we have riches that can't be taken from us, and therefore we don't need to look to riches as our glory, since we have our glory in His redemption, which then frees us to give. What does Marley lament unto Scrooge at the beginning of the story? He laments that he failed to see in life, quote, "Mankind was my business. Charity, mercy, forbearance, benevolence, those were all my business. The dealings of my trade were but a drop of water in the comprehensive ocean of my business." The more you grasp the love in Christ's redemption, the more you are animated to see others freed to a different kind of life, whether it's physically, socially, or spiritually. And if it's true that the redemption in Jesus is ours, then we have the most reason to be glad, even in your sorrow. Because if we are understood, and we are favored, and we are furnished, and we are promised a full and final redemption, then there is a gladness to be had even of our sadness. Brothers and sisters, what's eating you right now? What's the one thing you're most worried about and you're stymied by? What's the one thing that's depleting you of strength? Whatever that might be, would you ask yourself this question in prayer this week? How does the fact that we have been redeemed from an eternal death, redeemed from a righteous wrath, redeemed from an abiding folly, how does that help you rethink the one thing that you're hobbled by? If it's true, how does that cause you to rethink whatever you think is desperate? It may not change the fact of it, but by the Spirit of God, it will change the experience of it. And that's why every version of A Christmas Carol tends to end on that little tender note by Tiny Tim when he says, God bless us, everyone. In the redemption that came through Jesus, he has. In the redemption that came through Jesus, he will. In the name of the Father, and the Son, and the Holy Ghost. Amen.